Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is 12 p.m. on the dot, and we are going to go ahead and kick off another session of Journal Club. Today, I'll get to our guest speaker in a moment, but I want to start with just reviewing our agenda. We are going to go over COVID-19 state of the state, and then we're going to have a discussion about non-COVID patients. I wanted and hope to do some emerging research, but in the interest of time, I really wanted to give way to our discussion. There will be time for us to have open dialogue and questions to be addressed. So, we want to make sure that we are just giving enough time to have this conversation. So just to jump in, we're going to get started with where we're at globally, over 23 million cases. I think we're all pretty familiar with that. In the country, if you go to the next slide for me, Shane, we are seeing that we're at about 5.7 million cases. This is from Johns Hopkins. I just looked at the Worldometer, and they're reporting 5.8 million plus cases in the United States. There's been a lot of updates since we last spoken about what's happening. And I saw something recently this morning about what the CDC is now recommending as far as possibly not testing everyone who's been exposed. So more to come on that as it unfolds. Hopefully we'll be able to really get some detailed information out to everyone. But, we're still in the thick of it. The United States positivity rate is 6.92%. If you go to this, yes, thank you, Shane, to this slide, we still see that 30 states have a higher than recommended positivity rate, which is the recommended rate by the World Health Organization is to be at 5%. So the state of Florida, we are at 13.64%, which is significantly less than where we were a few weeks ago, but we are still, like I said, we're still getting new cases. We are still seeing more people who are positive. If you go to the next slide, where Florida was reporting this morning, they're saying that we're at 588,602 total cases in the state of Florida, but if you look at the Worldometer, they're saying it's now 600,000 plus. So we have to wait to see what those new numbers really look like. There are now task force there's one in particular that's addressing reopening nursing facilities and visitations. Unfortunately, we as the society who our experts at post-acute and long-term care medicine, we were not invited to be on that task force. And unfortunately, there's not a clinician on that task force who really addresses our space. So there's a lot of challenges that we're seeing here in the state and that we need to address. When we look at how testing is going for all the mandates that we have for testing in the state of Florida in our nursing facilities, if you go to the next slide, you'll see that our positivity rates for staff is at 2.13%, if for residents at 2.98%. So, we are still, doing the testing and guidance with what CMS has recommended, which is weekly testing for any state that is over 5% with the positivity rate. I haven't heard any feedback on this, but if there is something that's happening out there that is different than what is recommended, please let us know. I say all of this as we're going through the state of the state because in the last few weeks, since we last spoke, the thing that has stayed on my mind is what's happening with everyone else. You know, we know we have our dedicated COVID units. We have a lot of rules and in place and a lot of guidelines, but thinking about reopening, thinking about visitation, all of those things makes me think about what the non-COVID patients' experience has been, both in our facilities as well as in our offices. And I will say from where I sit with United Healthcare, we are getting information about declines in utilization as far as our members going to see their primary care doctors and visits being done, surgical procedures being delayed. And so I wanted to have a conversation around this. And when I was thinking about who would be the best person to tap, I reached out, if you go to the next slide, to Elizabeth Galick, Beth for short. And I'm going to let I'm going to keep calling you either Dr. Galick, Elizabeth, or something.
Just call me Beth.
I'm going to let you introduce yourself to our group here today.
Okay. Thanks very much, Diane. So my name is Beth Galick, and I'm a professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing and a nurse practitioner. And I engage in educating nurse practitioner students and medical students and anyone interested in geriatrics at the university and some other places. I do federally funded research focused mostly in long-term care settings with older adults with dementia who've been hit pretty hard by this pandemic and, you know, I think have kind of taken the brunt of things in terms of social isolation and decline. And I continue to practice as a nurse practitioner in community and long-term care settings, mostly in assisted living right now. And my practice is really focused, while it's been broader in the past, focused on what I refer to as dementia symptom management. And so if you want, I have like a couple of slides, Diane, I can just kind of set the stage and then we can take questions. I'll share my screen. I tried to send them to you ahead of time, but they were too, I have a lot of pictures in it and it was too big. But I'm going to need you guys to allow me to share my screen.
So Shane, can you turn it over?
I just made you a co-host, Beth.
Okay, cool. All right. Let me see if I can do it now. I'm always a little technologically challenged. Okay.
Well, that's okay. My kids know how to use Zoom better than I do.
I know. Mine too. There we go. It's trying. Okay. So the practice, as I mentioned before, that I'm engaged in clinically is predominantly in assisted living, and I go to different settings. I also do a little home care. So I go normally, not in a time of COVID, I go to people's private homes when they have individuals who live there or are living with dementia who, for whatever reason, it's either hard to get them out of the house due to medical issues or gait problems or, because of behavioral symptoms, they don't like going into an office and are more comfortable in their own home. So I see a small number of people in that situation. And then I see people kind of across the care spectrum of assisted living, some small kind of group homes or senior care facilities that may have, 8 to 16 people living in them versus some larger facilities. And I've been very fortunate. The residents and patients that I've cared for during COVID-19 have not been affected by the infection. However, there's a lot of the larger facilities in which I engage in some research and things that did get affected. But we're just going to talk a little bit about some of the things that I've seen over the past couple of months and challenges and hopefully some solutions. I'm trying to advance this. Okay. So as you can imagine, the impact of COVID-19 on residents has been pretty significant. Even if we're, looking beyond just the infection control issues. So social isolation has been a big problem and has really kind of contributed to a lot of the other things that we're seeing in terms of cognitive decline, particularly among those with dementia, but also, you know, if people had even mild cognitive impairment, we're seeing some people with some cognitive decline just because they're not getting that engagement anymore. While early in the pandemic, from others I practice with and other colleagues, we all kind of, for the first 2 months, found that those with dementia and behavioral symptoms, there was kind of not a whole lot of behavioral issues early on. However, as the pandemic has progressed, now we're starting to see more and more of that. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Another big problem has been the lack of physical activity. There's been a lot of room restrictions. So I'm in Maryland, and we were about 2 weeks behind New York City in terms of when we experienced the peak in our infection rates. And so over the summer, I've seen a lot of challenges in terms of people being limited in what they can do and move around. And we're now kind of trying to get back to that and thinking a little outside of the box about how we can keep them moving in facilities and how we can get therapy in to kind of help but keep everybody safe. And then this has obviously led to increased functional disability. And Diane mentioned the postponement of medical care, as well as caregiver stress on the family's parts, because they're in many instances serving as advocates and even adjunct caregivers, particularly for those with dementia, and not being able to see their loved one outside of FaceTime or a window visit or a door visit. Now in Maryland, some facilities are allowing people to have outside visits. So that's been a good addition, but things are really moving slowly. So there's a lot of caregiver stress. So with the families, as well as with the staff who are caring for residents, because they've had to kind of deal with everything with no break. So this is just kind of, for the first 2 months of the pandemic, I wasn't doing any visits. It was kind of recommended. Everybody was on a pretty significant lockdown, and I did telehealth. And afterwards was finding some limitations in terms of telehealth, which we'll talk about. And now I'm doing more kind of outside doorway window visits or inside with some physical distancing to try to get a better sense of what's going on. So with telehealth, obviously it's the safest. And the other nice things about it, you're able to include family who may not be living with the patient. So if they have a caregiver who's kind of at a distance, you can include them. It was very confusing since my population all has cognitive impairment. Trying to engage with them on a screen, I'd say 75% of them was rather difficult. They didn't really understand it. They couldn't really attend to it. And I didn't know how much was the technology and how much could have been an underlying delirium. So that made things a little confusing. Also, you need to have a caregiver who has some technologic savvy someone who can help with parts of the exam as well. And I was finding that I was missing exam findings from the waist down. There was a gentleman who had, I got a call from him about a behavioral problem. He had pretty significant vascular dementia, had been stable for some time, and then was having difficulty sleeping at night, and was getting increasingly more aggressive and taking off his shoes and throwing them at people in the evening time. To make a long story short, it wasn't that he needed more antipsychotic or other medication. It was he had an infection in his toe, and he was diabetic, and it was painful. And I just had this funny feeling after I did the telehealth visit with him, and I was in the neighborhood, and I said, bring him to the door. I'll stand 6 feet back, and I'll put a mask on, and let me just look at him. And asked some pointed questions and finally figured out with one of the caregivers that, you know, to take off his shoes, and we were able to see that he had a infection in his toe. So that's been some of the challenges related to telehealth. So I've been doing a lot more of these kind of outside visits, and you know, I like them because there's a decreased risk of exposure, not as much as telehealth, but it's great for observation. And you can do, with some modifications, which I'll show you, you can do a pretty decent mental status exam with patients. You can assess their gait, which has been huge to try to kind of screen for these problems in decreased mobility and fall risk. You can, with some help from a caregiver, you can do a musculoskeletal exam, and you know, you can look at skin integrity, edema, and some aspects of a neuro exam. The distancing that I try to do with these visits can make communication a little challenging, and it's not helpful when you really need to palpate or auscultate things. But so here's some pictures of kind of some different settings and what they've set up. So two of the pictures are showing a caregiver and get things ready, and a student, a trainee that I'm working with. So we have the, you know, the providers outside, and inside is the patient. And another facility actually set up a little tent with basically it was a shower curtain, and to allow for people to be able to see, but to help prevent exposure. In terms of communication at a distance, now this is kind of when they're only available, and you have to be careful if you're sharing these devices. Usually you have to have a different headset, and you can just share the pocket talker itself to, you know, for infection control purposes. But for people who have a hard time hearing, some of the facilities have purchased these pocket talkers, and they'll put the headset on the patient, and they'll put that next to the window with the screen up, and they can hear really well that way. And it's also been helpful for family visits, because with family visits, particularly if it's a spouse, often they're both hard of hearing, and if you're separating them by 6 foot distance, you know, it's hard for them to have a conversation. Other places I know have used walkie-talkies and kind of cleaned them in between. They've done that more for family visits. And when I go to see a patient now with these kind of modified outside visits, I tend to call first and do the history by phone, and, you know, reconcile the meds, do all that piece of it on the telephone, and then I'm going and then doing the exam in person. But it's a shorter time and a shorter exposure for everybody. And, you know, as we were mentioning before, the common challenges including cognitive decline and functional decline, and then the behavioral symptoms we're seeing more of. So in terms of cognitive decline, I would recommend, if it's possible, to try to use a standardized instrument to assess people's cognition who you may be concerned of, so you can track them over time. It doesn't really matter which one you use, as long as it's appropriate for the person and can kind of track them where they are in the disease process. And trying to find out, if you're working with multiple facilities, what has been the social and cognitive stimulation within those particular facilities? It's varied widely for me. So in some of the smaller places where I go, it's actually been pretty good because they have live-in caregivers who have agreed with some extra monetary, you know, extra pay to remain essentially in lockdown, or if they go out, then they, you know, spend some time, they get tested again before they come back in and have a brief quarantine. But for them, it's allowed them to not have to have residents out of their rooms, engaging with one another kind of in these small little safety pods you know, groups of people that they can see. So that's helped a lot. Whereas other facilities, larger ones, people have been on room lockdowns in many cases. And that's been a little more challenging, particularly for people with dementia who can't often, because of their apathy, initiate anything to engage in activities. So even if you're delivering, you know, like a craft kit or things to people in their rooms, if they don't know what to do with it or need somebody to walk them through the steps, those things are going to be harder. we'll talk in a minute about some ways kind of around that in terms of activities and engagement. You want to try to get some information from the staff and also touching base with the family, because in many instances, they're talking to the staff, they're also seeing their loved one on FaceTime or, you know, some platform, and they may have some observations or things they're concerned about. It also makes them feel connected to the process because, you know, they're not allowed in yet. And then, have these cognitive changes resulted in a new safety risk? So is there increased wandering, more apathy? I've seen some cases, not many fortunately, where getting someone to eat adequately and drink enough has been a challenge because they need a lot of help. And or sometimes they just won't want to engage. So even if the staff is there to help them, they're declining in terms of their mood and need more support with their nutrition and hydration. And if visual spatial skills have decreased, that can also impact fall risk. So some other tips in terms of managing cognitive decline. I always assume at this point that the cognitive decline is probably some type of subsyndromal delirium until I prove otherwise. And I'm looking at medications, I'm doing a lot of deprescribing. Not only does it help in terms of lessening the impact of caregiver's time with MedPass, but I've been able to lower psychotropic meds. I don't have a lot of people on narcotics, but anticholinergic meds, removing a lot of these things that got put there that these folks just don't need anymore. And in general, people have been doing well with that. And then working with the staff, trying to be creative and matching appropriate sensory simulation activities for people with cognitive impairment. So favorite music or photos. So while you're in there, if you're helping make a bed or gather up dirty laundry or whatever, engaging with them, having them look at a photo album, do a simple puzzle, putting on their favorite music. So trying to basically multitask while you're in the room to encourage some engagement. And then trying as much as feasible to maintain some type of regular routine, which is hard because, you know, this pandemic has hit staff as well. And I know a few facilities that I've worked with have had massive staff outbreaks when we finally got enough test kits to be able to start testing everyone. And so there was, you know, a lot of people went into quarantine and couldn't work who were familiar with residents, and then you're bringing in other people who don't know folks. So it's been a challenge. So some of the things that we've been trying to encourage people to do is optimizing function and physical activity. One of the greatest tools that I found during the pandemic, because even people with some significant cognitive impairment, oftentimes if they've done it before, it's a familiar activity and it's repetitive, but these pedal stands work wonders. The picture of the woman, she's been engaged in this during the pandemic, and she was a cyclist before. And we brought this to her, and she had been doing very poorly, not sleeping well at night. There was, you know, her depressive symptoms started reemerging again, trying to do some things with meds. But I tell you, that pedal machine did more good for her than any antidepressant I think that I could give for her. And the caregivers were so creative that they have a computer, and they are able to pull up GoPro videos on YouTube that show, like, people tape them when they were doing their own biking trips. And so they say to her, you know, where do you want to go today? You want to ride in the mountains? Do you want to ride on the beach? And they're able to pull that up. So she really feels that she's riding. The other picture was not taken during COVID, but it's something that we've been able to incorporate across a couple facilities. It's just pool noodles, and probably right now in Florida, there's a lot of them on sale. And we cut them in half. The good thing is they can't hurt anybody because they're pretty soft. And you're able to clean them, well with sanitizing solution. And they're cheap enough that everybody can have a half of a pool noodle. And larger facilities have used these to do kind of activity and stretching exercises with people in their doorways. And it takes an activity staff member kind of usually working with a group of about six rooms if the doorways are close enough, engaging them in some of, resistance exercises and range of motion activities, stir the pot, pump iron, all kinds of different things. This lady's showing how she's bending them. It helps to prevent hand contractures for people who are more severely functionally impaired. So we've had a lot of fun with pool noodles. And then these are some other examples. People want to engage in meaningful activity, whatever that may mean to them. And here's, again, like a little sweeper that's inexpensive. And even if the carpet doesn't need it, it gets her a chance to get up, move about, and, engage in some physical activity. Because people have had trouble in terms of being in smaller spaces with dementia, they feel kind of closed in. Sometimes activities like shaving can be done more in a common area where there's more space, and you're encouraging the person to do it for themselves and then you kind of coming back later and maybe helping. And then lastly, outside activities are always great, and there's one of the caregivers doing a daily task in terms of taking out the recycling with one of the residents. Encouraging sit-to-stand exercises are things that can be done when there is room restrictions, and you can even do it when you're trying to when you're toileting somebody, kind of doing an extra sit-to-stand exercise. So this is something to share with the frontline staff who are working with the patients, and it really does help to prevent falls and maintain some strength. We use some creative strategies with these kind of heavy foam horseshoes because their aim's not so good when they're sitting, but we tell them stand on up and you're going to get a ringer that way. And it's a way to get several sit to stand exercises, and you can space people out to do this. So having some physical distancing. So just some tips in terms of motivating long-term care residents. We've talked a lot about this. The important thing is just try to make it fun. Have role models at a distance and try to incorporate it into stuff that you're already doing. And here's some pictures of some outside activities. You can see people are pretty physically separated, but they're able to go out and get a little fresh air. I know that after being pretty restricted in my home, except for because the university won't let us back on campus, aside from my clinical visits, I spent a week more or less restricted in another place on a vacation and a home we rented. And it did wonders just having something different to look at and getting a chance to walk someplace different. So getting people outside is helpful. This is just a website that has some training videos, not really COVID specific, but it's designed to teach frontline caregivers and family members how to optimize function and physical activity. There's I think about seven of them. And then further down is also some newer ones that we just did this past fall that focus on people with behavioral symptoms and cognitive issues and how to engage them. And I've been doing a lot of DICE. I kind of did this anyway, but I've been doing a lot of this with the caregivers with telehealth or by phone when they're contacting me about patient behaviors, really kind of trying to get them to give me a good description of the behavior rather than just saying, the person's agitated, can we have more of X, Y, and Z? And in terms of medications, and really trying to get down to what's going on. That example that I gave you earlier of the gentleman who was throwing his shoes, that was a behavioral symptom, but really was a result of a physical medical disorder and pain. So I'm taking some extra time to use this with staff and kind of teaching them about it so that hopefully when they call me in the future, they've had a chance to kind of think about what all the impact of these different things are, and so that we can kind of go through that process. And there's a link and more information related to it. And then this is just a little wheel, really talking about some tips for managing behavioral symptoms and things I've been sharing with the staff. We're exploring triggers for people who have severe dementia. They've been in a lot of isolation, and if a staff member comes in and then kind of starts talking real quick and touching them and moving them and doing a bunch of things, it's kind of a big shift for them. So kind of going about that a little more gradually and avoiding too much talk and too much touch. Role modeling, trying to get people to do things themselves rather than washing the resident, having them engage in that process, because at least it gives them some range of motion and something to do. And because there are so many restrictions in place, I think I found that caregivers have slipped back a little bit and are, I found that they were really good about this, but now that there's all these restrictions, they're saying no more often. And when you say no, particularly to someone with dementia, like, no, you can't do that, or you have to stop, or no, you can't do this, they tend not to hear that very well. And so working on those basic communication skills again and saying, if the person's out of their room, if there's nobody else there, take them for a little walk, turn them back around, take them back in their room, you know, have them wash their hands. Usually it's not a major issue. And then just trying to empathize with the emotions that are being expressed, especially when you're working with families, and again, trying to avoid the meds when possible. These are other caregiver resources that they're all kind of little, well, the Function Focused Care and the UCL training videos are all videos. They're all freely available. It don't cost anything. You don't have to pay. And the Nursing Home Toolkit just has a lot of information about promoting positive behavioral health in long-term care settings, particularly nursing homes. So that's it kind of for my, just what I've noticed and what we've tried to do here in Maryland over the past couple of months. But I'm happy to take your questions or your observations.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
Yeah, I thank you for that. You know, it's really interesting to see the way you're engaging for activities and therapy, because I think that's been a major challenge for us. I wanted to know, a lot of those pictures, I didn't see any masks. And I think in many of our facilities, we're having people who are masked, and it's been a challenge. I had a nurse send me a message asking, you know, if I had any thoughts about how to keep certain patients in their mask because it's such a challenge. What have you guys done differently or are doing?
So one thing that's happened, some of these pictures were taken kind of pre-COVID. Obviously, I've not been in facilities, so haven't been able to take as many photos that way. Some of the smaller places that are essentially contained bubbles have not had to use a lot of masks because they've not had people in or out, and we've done that distancing and the visits outside. So that's, and then when we do a visit with them, we have the person wear a mask. There are people who won't wear them. It's just challenging, or if they'll put them on, they'll take them off. It's hard. You have to kind of do the best that you can and not get into too big of a discussion of having, you know, what it's for, because a lot of times we're trying to explain something that they may or may not be able to understand. particularly if they have cognitive impairment. However, if they don't, you know, you can, a lot of times they've seen it on the news and have some understanding. But sometimes if they won't wear a mask, we have them wear a face shield, and it's better than nothing. They seem to feel a little bit better about that. Also, in terms of comfort of the mask, sometimes the disposable masks are, some of the residents are uncomfortable. And a student I worked with had purchased, or she hadn't purchased her, it was donated. They had a lot of nice soft cloth cotton masks. And again, even though they're not perfect, it's better than nothing. And if you can get people to wear the soft cotton mask, there's a group called, they make see-through masks that are kind of like shields that fit over. Yeah,
I know what you're talking about.
And there's one group that has, I think it's called Clear Mask. They're FDA approved. So in certain instances, we've used that. And when staff are in PPE, it's confusing. People don't, some of the residents don't recognize people. And they make like a 4x6 name tag holder. And so the staff have, in some facilities, have taken pictures of themselves smiling with no PPE and put that like on themselves so that they can show the resident, like a lot of times they still recognize the person, like, this is me. Like, you may not, you can only see my eyes and, you know, my hair is covered up and all the things that are familiar aren't there anymore. So those are some strategies, you know, that we've used. And let's see. Some of the staff have tried to make things kind of fun. They've had one place had a Christmas in July party, and the staff wore kind of goofy sweaters. And Now, when you have a COVID outbreak, a lot of these things you can't do, but some facilities have even cohorted people. So they've, like, once they've been tested and kind of shown to not, you know, have COVID, they've kind of grouped people so that they can have, you know, a couple days a week maybe of dining. They're still physically distanced, but
they're together.
But they're together to try to minimize the social isolation. So a lot of it's just being creative and figuring out what you're doing, and then just clearly documenting how you're trying to kind of balance the needs of the residents in terms of preventing infection, but also minimizing the negative impact of social isolation.
I like the comment that you mentioned about the wanderer, because I was thinking about our hopeless wanderers who are, I mean, they're going to wander no matter what you give them, no matter what you do. The redirection of that, I could see as being a significant challenge if you have someone in fully attired PPE. Mm-hmm. It could be very frightening, I would imagine.
Yeah. And some of the residents, you know, have said, there's all these people running around here in masks. Like, they don't understand. They're running around here in masks, and I don't know what they're doing. And, you know, it's confusing. Some of the one place that did a fair amount of cohorting, they cohorted all their wanderers together.
And
yeah, they put them in this section, and they were fortunate enough to, like, the doors don't lock, but they kind of put them all together in this one little end of a wing. And they let all the families know, like, this is what we're going to do, because we don't want to sedate them to keep them in their room. We can't have them, you know, walking out amongst everybody, but we can do this. And families were very supportive of that. Because they, you know, really saw that that was trying to meet the needs of their loved one. And, you know, while not perfect, it helped. And, you know, there is increased risk because they are wandering around one another, but, you know, they have a staff member kind of assigned to them, and, you know, to kind of try to engage them and keep them all in that little smaller area.
So did you guys see any spikes in psychotropic use in your area? We've seen a little bit of that in Florida.
We have not, surprisingly. Like I said, we may be seeing that now, and we haven't had the report come out recently. But initially, I've done more, and I've heard from my colleagues, we've done more deprescribing. Mm-hmm. There's always people that... But it tends not to be throughout the whole building where there's been certain issues where you have had to go up in some instances. But overall, we experience less and I probably more antidepressant use than anything else. So not as much antipsychotic, not as much benzo, but more antidepressant, I think.
So you mentioned earlier that the caregiver stress. What have been the biggest challenges around dealing with the family members as well as the caregivers who are in the facilities?
So first with the family members, I guess the biggest thing is dealing with the anger. And I'm used to them being upset with me. I don't like it, but... I understand it. I think it's harder for the staff that are in there day in and day out, who are making all kinds of changes in their own lives to try to, keep themselves safe and then keep the residents safe. And they're doing what's mandated by CDC and CMS, and then they have family members kind of screaming and yelling at them. So one of the caregivers said to me that she had a family member out in the parking lot when she was leaving work, and come there at this particular place, there was a COVID outbreak. And the family member was screaming, "How could you have let this happen? How could you have let this into the facility?" I think that you can understand where they're coming from because they're frustrated and they feel like there's nothing they can do. But I think that's probably been the hardest piece on the staff. There's another facility I worked with that was one of the first in Maryland to have a major outbreak. They had 12 deaths and, or not that many. Yeah, about 12 deaths and, 40 some people impacted. And it was a larger facility, a CCRC. And there, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but the residents and the families kind of rallied around them. And they had a whole different trajectory moving forward. So they were, here in Maryland, it gets posted, if you have a positive case, it gets posted on a site that's updated once a week. And while they had an early outbreak and they also resolve things quickly and also were able to, the families and the residents who were able kind of went outside and had daily parades at shift changes. So when the staff were coming in, they were kind of cheering for them, and it just reframed the whole picture. They're PT and physical activity kind of exercise wellness department made these great little videos for the residents to engage in exercise that they could access on their televisions or computers every day. And when people were coming out of their COVID isolation, there was a woman who was 103 and they encouraged her to walk. And she did, and they taped it, and they got permission, and then they posted it, and it was in the paper. So there was a lot of positivity. The other thing that facility did that I think other facilities may not have done to the extent that this one did is they were very honest and upfront before things were being posted here in Maryland. They were communicating with the families with a weekly new kind of newsletter, as well as a call where people could ask questions. So they really opened the lines of communication early. They were honest. They were talked about, you know, what they were doing, and they had a very different trajectory than a lot of other places that had major outbreaks, mostly because they had that support.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I mean, I think that's wonderful. I know we had a couple of facilities down here before it, you know, our second spike in cases. They were doing parades and some other things to really celebrate the staff and have the family members come out and at least see people. So I think those are like amazing and wonderful ideas. I'm wondering how, and maybe you could shed some light, what has been the impact of us changing our operations in our buildings? You know, some patients were probably getting labs and x-rays more frequently than they are now, going out to the specialist. What have you seen? And is there any delays in care that are concerning for you and your team?
So kind of good changes and bad changes. I think sometimes those x-rays that were being ordered, you know, maybe you could get by without having as, or some of the labs, where in other instances, it was more significant. The place that had the little tent, they eventually put up a tent that was, could be kind of private, and they used that for medical procedures. So like if somebody needed to have a catheter changed, they would bring them out there so that could be done with the home health nurse that was coming into, you know, the small little group home. So people got creative about how to do those type of things. I think seeing specialists, that's kind of dropped off significantly, or it's happening via telehealth.
It can be good or bad.
Yeah, it can be, you know, and in working with facilities, we're just trying to prioritize what's really important, who needs this. A colleague out in Arizona was telling me a story yesterday where her husband's a CMD at a facility, and the transport to take one of the residents to dialysis didn't show and wasn't going to show. And the nurse was in tears, but they basically, the facility was about three blocks away. And so the staff wheeled the resident over there.
Oh my God.
I know. So I know. Yeah. It's challenging. I think you're seeing less people go out to the ER, which can be a good, you know, can be a good thing. But also I think it's when people have really needed it. So I had someone who got very bradycardic and needed to have a pacemaker placed, and he went in, and because in the hospital they still wouldn't allow families to come in, and they weren't communicating very well with the family. When he came back, it was kind of a disaster, and the family took everything out on the staff that they could have access to. So there were still issues. Things were still going on when he came back, and because the facility staff were the ones that they could call and access, they were screaming and yelling at the staff there. I think that's been the hardest piece for the staff to deal with. The other thing that I think has helped for facilities is, like, I know we're all using telehealth, but I think it's important in when it's medically warranted. In some instances, having that medical director or the nurse practitioner or the provider come in, and because the staff have to come in. And so having that leadership present on site, I think helps with morale and, you know, kind of equalizes the picture a little bit, and makes the virtual visits later, I think, better. If they understand that you're willing, when it's needed, to come in.
I definitely agree. I think that's been an area where we've a lot of conversations that I've had here in Florida, like when should you come in? How do we meet those challenges? I think the president of FAMDA, he was explaining that he had a patient who was in the hospital for 2 weeks and had not been seen until, I guess, he came to the nursing facility by any doctor, like face to face.
Right.
You know, so I think that is a real big challenge. And it makes me wonder about the way we are doing things as a whole. You know, what's going to stay around, what's going to need to change, and mm-hmm. how we're going to need to approach our patients, you know, both like in and out of the facilities. Yeah.
The telehealth has been a great tool, but it doesn't solve everything. And unless there's a plan in place to have non-nursing staff working to kind of go around with that, the camera and the computer and everything, it gives the staff something else to do. And they do it because it's important, but it just puts another added burden on them. The other thing that I've seen kind of fall off a bit that I think we'll have, we may see more of this come the fall, which will be pretty bad, is less oral care. That's kind of gotten shifted for people who can't do it themselves, or if somebody's going to fight you and you're sweating under multiple layers of PPE, and you know that's creating droplets, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I had a thought about that. That would be a big challenge.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
A big source of issues as far as if we have patients who are already not engaging and they're not getting their oral care, what could happen with the way they eat, everything.
It just has a lot. And I think we're not going to see the sequela of that until further in the fall. But I think it's coming. The places I've been working with, I've been trying to, for the residents who can, even just like hold a toothbrush, even if they don't get toothpaste on it, you know, if you dip it in a little mouthwash or something, even if they're able to do a little bit to get some of that debris off, you know, it helps.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. And I don't think we mentioned that you're the editor-in-chief of Caring for the Ages, the AMDA publication. Is there something that that you're thinking about doing to really highlight all of those maybe missing points that we're not addressing?
So actually, yes. Our October issue that's going to be coming out shortly, in early October or late September, is dedicated, about half the articles in there are about physical activity. And many of them really touch on how we can work to maintain some degree of physical and functional activity in our residents, you know, keeping COVID in mind. Also, we have an article that's addressing a lot of the mouth and oral care issues, mm-hmm. and with interviews and resources from Mouth Care Without a Battle and some of the nation's experts in terms of oral care. So that's coming down the pike.
And that wasn't a setup question. I didn't know.
No, it's fine. It's actually, but I was reviewing a lot of the articles this morning, so they were kind of fresh on my mind.
Now, I saw an article in JAMDA about music and memory. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you know, in thinking about all the things that you were showing us, the walkie-talkies, all the possibilities, have you seen anyone implement a music program during this pandemic that for those residents, just to keep them engaged or entertained?
So, you know, I've seen people use throughout, they've not necessarily done it during the pandemic, but throughout have tried to use music to try to help. The challenge with music is often the music that's either going to be calming or engaging someone to move or walk or whatever has to be individualized.
Yeah.
And so what might be preferable to one person isn't going to be for others, and not everyone will wear those little headsets. I think it's a tool in the toolbox. I think it helps, particularly for people with later stage dementia, because the part of the brain that deals with our with music is further back and doesn't get affected so much until later. So I think that's why it works. And it's another tool, but again, it's not a panacea. There's one lady pre-pandemic that had pretty severe dementia, couldn't really talk, and she didn't understand when, she could still walk, but needed help, and she didn't understand when staff were trying to take her to the bathroom. And so they would try to kind of lift her up, pull her up, and she would go the other direction. Mm-hmm. And with her, they used music. She liked big band music. And so they put it on a little boom box that they had, and they would dance up to her and then put their hand out, kind of like, come be my dance partner. No words. And she would hold the hand and then stand up. And so they used that as a method to get her to stand up without resisting and fighting. And so, you know, you can use music in a lot of ways. I don't think it has to be a set program where like everybody has to be hooked to their
to iPhone or I know it's just something that has always interested me. You know, when I lived with my grandmother who had dementia, it was a way that we kept her engaged, and I just learned to sing to patients, you know, depending on what they like. And I've already told my kids that if I end up in a nursing home, make sure they play something like Bon Jovi, classical, because, you know, if you want me to be entertained or get up and do something.
Exactly. So
it's interesting, and I'm, still unpacking that study, but I'm like, okay, you know, maybe given all the opportunities, the challenges that this pandemic has raised, but there's still opportunities for us to think differently and to address things differently.
And to try, I think one thing that's been nice about this is because we've had to be flexible to deal with so much of this, people are more willing to try something new that before they would have been like, no, we don't do it that way or what have you.
Well, Beth, do you have any, closing statements or remarks for us?
Just, you know, everybody hang in there and keep doing what you're doing, and be flexible and be forgiving, because everyone I think is a little on edge, with staff, with families, it's hard, and I think we have to do our best not to take things so personally.
That is some good advice. Thank you for joining us today.
Easier said than done, though.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Beth. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care.